We're continuing with John Locke and his empiricist theory of knowledge and reality. And today I just want to make some summary comments. We've talked about its main points at some length now. And I want to do a brief recap of some of the faults that we've found with this. So let's take my jot them on my whiteboard. All ideas are of sensations or reflection. Locke tells us this over and over. Everything that's in the mind has to be a sensory perception or a reflection on the operations of the mind. Can't be anything else. But this statement itself, if we can know this to be true, is not a perception and it's not a reflection. I said to you, he's going to be inconsistent. He's going to want to rule out self-evident statements, but he's going to appeal to them. He's going to say there are none, and then he's going to use them. And this is an example. Second point, he keeps the idea of substance, even though it turns out to be a something I know not what. He says all the other properties that things seem things exhibit to our experience look like properties that have to be properties of something. There has to be something else. The property itself can't exist, just floating in midair or something like that. But that means there has to be a something that all the properties of the thing inhere in. And so he keeps the idea of substance. And my objection was, this is where Christians should say, this is only God, or the power of God, to be more precise. God holds, through Christ, holds all things together. And I take that means even the properties of things so as to constitute the nature of that type of thing. So this is just a spot here where I think, as a Christian, he missed the boat. Third, I mentioned to you early on that there was a difference between the epistemological question, how do we know that, and the question that is ordinarily meant in the street when somebody asks, how do you know that? That question, so that I call this here a historical answer. That means somebody says to you, how do you know that? And you tell them the history of how you found that out, how that information came to you. Or you say, I read it in the encyclopedia, or I and a bunch of the other fellows were having a big bull session last week, and we covered all possible possibilities and came out with this. Now that's a historical answer. That tells you how you came across the information. That's not what somebody's asking for in epistemology. In epistemology, they are asking, how do you know that is true? Not where did you get it? What's its justification? And that second question is the epistemological one. And we can see that in what we've heard about Locke, what I've read from him, that Locke gives the first type of answer to the second type of question. When epistemology wants to know what justifies you in regarding this as true, Locke says, gives an account such as it came through the senses or it's an idea of reflection. That may be where you got it. I'm not primarily interested in that. I want to know why you think it's true. And he often doesn't tell us. And many places, and I read them to you last time, a number of them, he says, it's evident. Well, it's just evident this is right. And that's a sneaky backhanded appeal to self-evidence that he says he ruled out. He disagrees with Descartes. And that's another place where he gets something really wrong. Descartes says that when we do certain procedures, for example, we measure two triangles and we find that they're congruent. And we see that we have several, do it several times, and we see that wherever the two are equal, angle side angle, that they're congruent. And so we put this down as a law in geometry. It's a necessary truth. But Descartes doesn't say that we derive the law from the perception of these two being congruent. They're the same size and shape because they're equal angle, side angle. What happens, according to Descartes, is that we see this in perception, in our perceptual knowledge. We perceive the two triangles. We put one on top of the other, and they overlay one another perfectly. And that provokes the rational intuition that grasps that this is a law. That's another way of saying it becomes self-evident that they're all going to be like this. So I don't have to see every triangle a million years ago and a million years to come, and I don't have to see them in the far distant reaches of the universe. It doesn't matter where or when. Two triangles are going to be congruent if they're equal in these ways. So for Descartes, perception primes the pump. Perceptual knowledge gets our rationality rolling, and then once it gets rolling, it sees this self-evident truth and that one and the other one. It formulates even the laws of logic, such as the law that nothing can both be true and false at the same time, in the same sense. So it's both. We see it perceptually. Perceptually, we see examples of it. Examples of it provoke in us the intuition, oh, this is universally true. Locke missed that. He criticizes Descartes for saying that perception can give us universal truths. Descartes does say that, but he says it in the sense I just explained. Perception, the universal truths aren't derived from the perception, they're provoked by the perception, getting our rational intuitions going and then us seeing that they're self-evidently true. And finally, we have Locke telling us, oh, I wrote these down, I want you to see this. Make it easier for you to copy them. Although undoubtedly your handwriting is better than mine. I can't, though, go on apologizing for that because I can't help it. Perception leads us to the idea of causation because we have the experience that we know through our senses of willing our bodies to do something, my hand to pick up this stylus or adjust my glasses or whatever it is, and we know that the body acts in obedience to the mind's commands. So this gives rise to the idea of a power, Locke says. And this idea of power means that one thing exerts effects on another. And we don't see the power that we don't see perceptually. You know, it's not a legitimate criticism to say what color is the power or how does it taste? Is it salty? No, it's not a perceptual object. But what we see happen among the perceptions and repeatedly gives us the idea that one exercises a power on the other. And that non-sensory, not able to be perceived directly, power is combined then with the seeing that one thing affects another to produce the idea of causation. And that's where we get the idea of one thing causing, affecting another. And now we're off to the races because we can do physics and other sciences, astronomy and so on, chemistry, because we have a legitimate law concept of causation. That may well be how we come to the idea of causation. I'm not sure. Certainly that's the first place we experience it, is in ourselves, that we will something. Get this off my face, and my hand shoves it off my face. And it seems to me that kind of stuff happens at a very young age. So we grow up assuming that our bodies are going to respond to our minds. In fact, it seems to me further that If we were brought up in a room, I'm talking about from very young childhood, we're brought up in a room in which everything in the room responds to every desire I have. That is, when I will the curtain to go up, the curtain goes up. I will the chair come out from the desk, it comes out from the desk without any part of my body touching any of these things. They all just, they obey my will too. It seems to me right that I would grow up regarding that entire room as parts of my body. Surely as it stands, we just distinguish our body from everything else because it's that multi-aspectual, that thing that has all the different kinds of properties, but that responds to my will, obeys my will. So maybe that's initially where we get the idea, all right. Then we distinguish different kinds of causality corresponding to the different kinds of properties. So we have kinetic and physical and biological, logical causality, technical causality, social, economic, so on. Well, I think that's at least part of the story. I'm not willing to go to the wall for, say that's all there is to it. Locke got the whole picture. But it seems to me here he got part of it, and that much is right. So what practical use does Locke make of this? Now, if he's got an epistemology about how we know, and it entails a certain ontology, that there's a real world of things in it that are represented faithfully and accurately by our perceptions, what practical use can he bring to it? And it starts with his ethics. And that's what we are going to dig into today, his ethics. To begin with, Locke commits himself to the very, what constitutes the very heart and soul of ethics. And that for him is pleasure as over against pain. So he's not willing to see that among all the kind of different kinds of properties that the things that we experience and our experiences have, there is not one kind called ethical. It's not that we experience things to be ethically wrong or ethically right and obligatory. We should do this and we should not do that. But instead, he wants ethics explained in a way that we nowadays call reductionist. He's going to reduce ethics, which in our experience seems to be a distinct kind of properties. There are actions that really have the property of being evil, we think. And there are others that really have the property of being good. And we should do the good and avoid the evil. No, he reduces all that to pleasure and pain. And those are sensory properties. We experience them as sensations. And I guess that's why he did it, because he's been yelling at us for a while now that the only things in the mind are perceptions and reflections on how the mind works. So ethics has to be one or the other. It's perceptions. Which perceptions? Pleasure and pain. We experience some things for the most part, cause more pain than pleasure for most people. So those are evil. Other actions, on the whole, produce more pleasure for more people, and so those are good. And that's how he wants to treat the ethical properties that we experience. We may think we experience an act as having the property of being wrong or praiseworthy, being right, but in fact, what they really are. Are types of actions that produce more pleasure than pain or more pain than pleasure. And I guess he would add for more people. That's the theory that comes up in the next century, in the 19th century, and it's the theory for which John Stuart Mill is famous, the utilitarian theory of ethics. And ethics is absolutely, by him, said to be that the right is whatever causes the most good for the most people, where good means pleasure. And an evil action is one that produces the most evil for the most people, where evil means pain. And they mean by that sensory pain. Okay. Ethics is then reduced by Locke to fit into his ontology and epistemology. And since he already got what's given to our experience and what we abstract from it backward, he takes the abstraction to be what's given and the given to be an abstraction. Right? Do you understand what I mean here? What's given to us are entire objects, concrete objects, with a multiplicity of kinds of properties and laws true of them. But he says, no, that's a construct of our minds. From that real picture or of what we perceive, he has abstracted certain kinds, colors, tastes, touches, sounds, and smells, and he says, that's what we experience. But those are all abstracted from the bigger picture. So he flips things, he's reversed them. The abstractions, he says, is what's given to experience, and the concrete objects are the our constructions, instead of getting it straight. So he can't take a full-fledged view of ethics. He can't say, among other properties, things, some actions have the property of being right and some have the property of being wrong. In the moral sense, some are evil and some are good. No, it's got to reduce to something that we can perceive. So it's power, it's pleasure and pain. And he adds, where there is no property, there is no injustice. So he's thinking here of ethics largely in the sense of the social ethics that holds across a given population. We're going to have rules about what they can do and not do. And we're going to say that some acts are evil and some acts are good. And the good, certain goods may be obligatory on everybody to do. They're not only good, but everybody must try to do them. And some evils are to be, and all evils are to be avoided completely because they produce more pain for more people. Well, how do you get from that to there's evil and good only if there's private property? Well, in the first place, Locke takes a very broad view of what he means by property. Property is anything you possess, and that includes your body and your life. So I don't think you and I would have thought that our lives are property. We'd think that that's other things that we possess, from land to houses to money and so on. But Locke takes a much broader view of it. So if anything is yours, and your body is yours, and your life is yours, then it's your property. So now it makes a little more sense to say there's no wrongdoing where there's no property. If you didn't own anything at all, if your life weren't your own, if your body weren't your own, then how can anybody do anything wrong against you? And he coins a phrase for this. What is yours, and what everybody does when they seek pleasure rather than pain, is they seek to protect life, liberty, and property. That's Locke. Jefferson changed the last one, the pursuit of happiness. But for Locke, it was your life, your liberty, and your property. Which includes your life and your liberty, by the way, and anything else you happen to own. So if you rightfully own it, if you own it because you earned it and didn't steal it, then it's rightfully yours and it's wrong for anybody to try to take it away. So he's off the ground, he thinks, with the ethics. Reducing right and wrong to pleasure and pain means that something that we all directly experience and know about is what constitutes the foundation of ethics. And it's not a property that's more abstruse, because it's not equivalent to pleasure or pain or anything else. And some things we just see to be wrong, and we make them so, we outlaw them. And it's because it's self-evident to us that they're wrong. Well, he can't take that view. So he wants this to account for everything in ethics. That, ladies and gentlemen, is going to be a tall order. Think about this for a while. Think about different people's ideas of what gives them pleasure. Suppose in Nazi Germany we have 80 million Nazis who get great pleasure out of torturing and killing 80,000 Jews. Doesn't that then, by this definition, turn out to be a right act? Seems to me it would. In fact, that act would be even more clearly right, ethically upright, the more pleasure it gave them. So if they didn't get that much pleasure, it's marginally okay. It's just over the line. It's among things that you can do. But if they got a whole lot of pleasure, well, it will be way up here. This is a super good thing to do. Look how much pleasure it's giving to the vast majority. And all we need is an example like that to see that this doesn't fly at all. Same on the other end for pain. This act gives me no pain, maybe. Maybe I enjoy it. That's something wrong anyway. I mean, think about the laws that people have had over what happens to a human body after death. We have laws on the book, most Western European and North American countries have laws on the book that you can't desecrate a human body, because we think it's actually derived from the idea that God has created us in his image, and that even after death, the human body deserves respect. But there are other cultures in which you honor the dead by eating their body. How are we going to sort that out? Which one's right? Well, just by pleasure and pain, I don't think you can. Right and wrong are not matters of vote. If 80 million Nazis find giving terrible pain to some tortured minority, whether it's Jews or Gypsies or people just getting in their way politically, the fact that a great many of them want it doesn't make it right. The ethical laws, as we intuitively grasp them, have to do with what is fair and just, and more than that, what is loving. That's the Christian view of ethics. It's summarized in the law of love. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. Now, there are a couple more things to notice about that. It doesn't say love your neighbor more than yourself. You don't have to sacrifice your good at every turn for any and everybody else. It says love your neighbor as. It implies a balance. You strike a balance between what's in your interest and what's in your neighbor's interest. They count too. Their humanity is as real as yours. And you're to show love toward them. And that you want to see them treated as you would want to be treated. Those are the Christian principles. In fact, St. Augustine summarized Christian ethics one time by saying, Christian ethics says love, and then do what you want. Because if it's guided by love, it'll be the right thing. And that's the major concern. And that's the axiom in ethics that never goes away. The rules all have exceptions, even the rule not to kill. If somebody's coming through the door with a gun in my house and he's going to kill my wife and children, it's my duty to stop him. If somebody's another country is trying to invade my country and enslave its citizens, it's part of my duty to stop him. So it's not always wrong to kill. It's not always wrong to lie. I had a professor, as an undergraduate, I had a professor who had lived in Nazi Germany through the Second World War and then come to the United States. And while he was in Germany, he was using his home, the basement of his home, to hide Jewish people and get them out of Germany. He was one stop along that underground railroad. And one night, when he had a number of Jewish families in his basement, a member of the Gestapo, the Nazi secret police, knocked on his door and said, "Herr Tienemann, have you seen any of the runaway Jews?" And without hesitating, he said, "No." And they said, "Thank you, good night," and they left. I should add, professors have more respect in Germany than in some other countries, mine included. But anyway, he lied. And that's just what he should have done. Love trumps the other rules. That's Christian ethic. Not let's reduce it to pleasure and pain. Let's acknowledge that there are things that are right and wrong that don't have much to do with pleasure or pain. At least not the sensory kind, right? If I steal an idea from you and I publish it as my own, we call that plagiarism. Plagiarism's wrong. It's ethically wrong. It's legally wrong, too. It's unjust as well as unloving. But the pain that might cause me isn't sensory pleasure pain. It's not like cutting my finger. Or even like a noise that's too loud, or a light that's too bright. It's not the bodily sort of pain. It's a creation of mine's been taken from me. And it's not right. No, it's not. It's not fair, that's why it's illegal. It's not loving, which is why it's not ethical. So I think Christians need to distinguish between what's fair as having to do with justice, and what's loving as having to do with ethics. And Locke doesn't get there. And in fact, he doesn't really get much of anywhere else. Saying it's pleasure and pain, how are you going to get around the example of the 80 million Nazis getting great pleasure out of torturing some minority of 80,000, and that makes that good for them? Makes it evil for the people getting tortured, but it makes it good for many more millions of people who are enjoying it. So that doesn't work. There's an answer that's been tried against that, and the answer goes like this. It's not the act that's going to produce the greater pleasure or greater pain. It's the rules we make that this applies to. So we can be utilitarian. We can say that good is pleasure and evil is pain. And what causes the most pleasure for the most people is good, and the most pain for most people is evil. But it's the laws that we set up, the legal laws and also ethical rules that we set up that reflect that. So it's not this instance of obeying or breaking the law, but the law itself. So we have a law against stealing someone's intellectual property. And we have that because it's ethically wrong. Why? Because it causes more pain than pleasure to the people who get robbed. But that's the reason for having the rule. So this is best explained by an example. Suppose a little child standing with his mother and he's watching the police march someone off to jail. And the child says, "Why are they putting that man in jail?" Then the proper answer, according to this theory, this rule, utilitarian view, is because he broke the law. If the child then asks, "Why do we have that law?" the answer is for the greatest good of the greatest number, where good means pleasure. But that runs into very deep difficulties also, because the same thing can happen. We can have an extremely unjust law that allows for the torture or compels people to torture some picked on minority, and it gives them great pleasure. And that's both the reason for persecuting the minority and for having a rule that we're to persecute the minority. So it avoids this difficulty in a few cases, but not all. So I think clearly this utilitarian view of ethics doesn't get off the ground. The ethical rules are apt to change, are subject to change with the opinions of the majority about what they find pleasurable and therefore good. Well, we have commands given to us in Scripture that are ethical commands. And the primary one is to love your neighbor as yourself. That's the axiom. The rules, then, that include don't steal, don't lie, don't envy other people's stuff, be faithful to your own spouse, all that has to do with rules that work out the vast majority of the time as expressing love. So I have to say, I think Locke missed the boat. He was a fellow believer, he was a Christian, but he doesn't see here what's unique about Christian ethics against the other theories. There are quite a number of other theories going around these days. We have people that want to revive the old virtue ethic of Aristotle. Ethics means cultivating certain virtues in your life so that your behaviors become second nature to you and you don't even want to do the evil thing, you just naturally do the good thing. Of course, the question is, what are the virtues and how do you know them? Well, we have utilitarianism, this view that we just covered, says the greatest good for the greatest number is what is good ethically. And we have Kantian ethics. We have the ethics of the last thinker we're going to cover in this course, Immanuel Kant. And Kant wants to say that no, ethical rules are just like the rules of logic and mathematics. They're rigid, they have no exceptions, and here's my formula for how to tell what's good from what's evil. He's going to lay it all out on the table. I think a bold attempt doesn't succeed. But most people who today want a fixed standard and that has some rational justification will say they follow a Kantian ethics. It's not his exactly, but it takes over the ideas that there are fixed rules that can be known and we can figure out, in most cases anyway, what's the right thing, the ethically right thing, and what's the ethically wrong thing to do. So we're going to get that too. I think myself that the love ethic that is proposed in the New Testament includes the others. Ethics is about virtue. It's about pleasure and pain too. And certainly about there being ethical rules that you follow even when it doesn't benefit you. But it's more. It's about the rule of love, and the rule of love will bring in and include all the others in a way that's coherent and makes sense. I'll add this, to be honest, I think the that's why I'm saying the rule of love, I think, does better than any of the others singly, because it will include them. But what it won't do, and this is what some people seem to want, it won't answer every ethical conundrum. It won't show you the right thing or wrong thing to do in every conceivable case, because in some conceivable cases there is no right thing. The only thing you could do, including do nothing, would be wrong. And so we opt for the lesser evil. So there are these tests that people give. They can confront them with some conundrum like that. You are on a railroad switch, gear switch location. You can throw the switch so that the train coming, you can hear it now in the distance, is going to take the left or the right turning on the track. But it's the train is running wild. It's way over speed. And it's clear that when it gets to those curves, whichever one it gets to, it's going to derail and hit the people that are there. And those people are too far away for you to yell to, and they don't have their cell phones on, you know, all that stuff. You can't reach them. So what are you going to do? There's one side, there's 25 people, and the other, there's 6. So is it just a matter of adding up the numbers? Or suppose you found out there were 25 ordinary people on one side, and these other 6 over here include a bishop, an atomic scientist, a philosopher, and a rock star. You going to save famous people, ones that make more difference to our culture? Is that a rule? And their conundrums like that are very difficult, and they aren't always solvable. Try to do what's most loving, but you can't always figure that out. Which is what I think Martin Luther had in mind when he said, you know, if there's no way you can avoid doing a wrong, a sin, then sin boldly. Pick one of them and do it. If that's all the only options you have. And he said something, you know, equivalent to God hates a wimpy sinner. And then he said, sin boldly, but trust in Christ just as boldly. We live in a fallen world, and we're part of it. And we can be confronted with circumstances in which, I said before, there is no good thing to do. And then we try to find out the least evil. And there's plenty of that. And there are some cases so bad that you can't even figure that out. I admit that up front. The love ethic isn't going to solve it any more than any of the others are. But it does give us a view of ethics that includes all the others. And builds on the idea of justice. I think that's distinct from ethics, but it's assumed. If something is just, the next question is, but is it loving? It may be fair, but is this the loving way to treat someone? Is it treating my neighbor, loving my neighbor as myself, the balance? Both. Notice that that's contrasted with the love of God. We love the Lord our God with all our heart, soul, strength, and might. Our neighbor as ourself. So there are no restrictions on what we owe God. The total devotion of our being to our maker, creator, and redeemer. And the one who will raise us from the dead and have us to live in his kingdom forever. To my neighbor, also in the image of God, I owe loving care and justice. And we distinguish those. One has to do with the law, the juridical order of society. The other, the ethical, the love order. And this gets developed in the 19th century to some great extent. It's going to be picked up by people like Jeremy Bentham, and especially by John Stuart Mill. And Mill is going to work out the entire, what was called in Bentham's time, the hedonic calculus. Hedonic means has to do with pleasure. The hedonic calculus is a Bentham seriously proposed that when we consider doing an action, before we do, we add up all its virtues and vices to see where it rates on the scale of pleasures. See, so now we have I'm contemplating doing this, and I look at how much pleasure will this give me and others if I do this, and maybe compared to all my other options right now, I give this an 8. It's high. I want to do it. And it's going to give me a lot of and the 8's higher than any of the other options. So I write down 8 under how much pleasure. How soon does the pleasure accrue to me? He called that its propinquity. And maybe that only comes out to a 5. There are other pleasures I could seek right now, and I'd get the results much quicker. Then there's the purity of the pleasures. A lot of pleasures come mixed with some not so good things that are actually in some small way or large painful. I can do this and I'll have this benefit, but it will release a terrible stink here, and I don't particularly want that. Anyway, what number would I put there? And we go through all these characteristics. I think there are 12 of them, and we rate them, and then we add up the numbers and we see what the total number is. And maybe the total number is 50-something. And we look at the other options of what we could do, and they all come out in the 30s and 40s. Then this is the right thing to do. That's the hedonic, the pleasure calculus. That's how we figure out what something is right or wrong. We add up the numbers. I think that has a relation to ethics, the way paint by the numbers has to art. Mill didn't try to do that with it. He said, our axiom is the greatest good for the greatest number, where good means pleasure and evil means pain. And that's where we leave it. And we try to have national policies and laws written in accordance with this. And one of our presidents in the U.S. said the same thing in his inauguration. I intend to follow the policy of the greatest good for the greatest number. That doesn't always lead you to do what's right, is my objection. And the law of love does. And the law of love will get him to all the people that the utilitarian axiom will, the greatest good for the greatest number. And it'll show up where the exceptions are and what you have to do with the policies to manipulate them and apply them at the local level so that they do turn out to be the most loving thing that we can manage. I won't go on about that because Locke didn't. He didn't go into great detail about the ethics, but he did take this position, the position that in the 19th century comes to be called utilitarian. And yes, that means the most useful. And yes, it means the most useful in the sense of what produces the most pleasure for the most people. Now, having given us at least this start on ethics, then Locke goes to politics, and he has a lot more to say about this. How to set up the government, how to set up the state. He's going to try to derive from his theory of reality how political theory should go. And that's where we're going to start next time. Locke's political theory. And he's going to begin with a conundrum that I've already given you before. We've considered it. And that is this question. Is human society, I'll put it this way. Is the basic social reality. The individual or the group. And the word some, I used group here because I thought it would be more familiar to you, but the word that's usually used in political theory is collective. Which is the basic unit. And that means exactly what you think it means. It means which one of these creates the other. And your political theory turns out to be wildly different depending on how you give your answer. If the basic political social reality is every individual, if human society started off with every single individual being alone and on his or her own and having a right to anything they could get, that's a natural kind of right, like preserve your life. Get as much as you can. Whatever you get, that's yours. There are not even families. According to this theory, you remember Hobbes? There are solitary individuals, they don't even marry. The sex is a random thing that just happens in the woods when nobody's looking, and so is birth, and people just get on the best they can, and everybody has the right to everything, and he called that the state of nature. That's the original state of human beings, and life in that state is solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. So they get together and they make a contract to give a sovereign power to rule them so that they don't have to live like that. That's one view. The other view says, no, it's the collective. It's the group of humans that produces individuals that can survive. Remember, two parents is more than one person. So that's a group too. Who feeds, cares for the mother right after she gives birth? Only she can take care of the infant, but who's going to feed her? Who's going to protect her? She's probably not in terrific shape to fight a battle. And the most primitive societies we've ever found, the circumstances in which we have found to be the most primitive in which human remains occur, are still extended families. There's no historical evidence for the individualism. Aristotle is a famous advocate of the collectivism. No, it's the collect. When the group of people gets large enough that it's self-sustaining, it can produce its own clothes, its own enough food for itself, it can house itself, and so on. And more than it takes two individuals to produce a new one, but the whole group for the new one to survive, then you have a state. Because in that state, there are going to be disputes, and there are going to need to be rules for how those disputes are settled, and there are going to need to be judges that will settle them. So in Aristotle's view, you get any large enough group of people that is self-sustaining, it's going to have laws, and somebody, either because they were elected or appointed or because they're just by their own charisma, will be regarded as the judge. People will come to that somebody and ask for a judgment in this particular case over this disagreement or whatever. And you have a state. You'll have a government, official or unofficial. So is that how states arise? Is it the collective? Or is it solitary individuals that decide to make a contract among themselves to create a state by giving someone all sovereign power to rule, to make the laws and enforce them? And historically, inevitably it has been that if someone starts out with the individualistic assumptions, they slight the rights of groups and the state itself in favor of the individual. Whereas if someone starts out with the collective as the basic social unit, they favor the collective and groups and slight the individual. And I can tell you right now which one of these is the Christian position. And the answer is neither one. It's not solitary, independent individuals that create collective groups. Nor is it collective groups that produce individuals that can survive because the group protects them. Aristotle's famous comment, the solitary individual dies. No, it's neither one. Because for obvious reason, my dear friends, that God created both. And he created them in relation, individuals in groups, right? Psalm 68, God sets the solitary individual in families. Remember what family would have meant to the psalmist, right? Family wouldn't have meant mother, father, child, bing, that's it. No, it would have meant grandparents, aunts and uncles. It meant extended family. In those days, a family was invariably a large number of people from our perspective, our point of view. It was 10, 12, 20 people, and sometimes more. No, God creates both individuals, and he creates that there are such things as families, and so on. So on the Christian view, it's not the case that good and evil is a matter of vote. It's not the case that even justice is a matter of only a vote, whatever anybody likes, whatever gives them the most pleasure. There are rules, and the fundamental axiom is the law of love, and individuals and the groups in which they live. That includes families, churches, businesses, labor unions, hospitals, artistic institutions, the government as the ruling body and the state. There are lots of them. And to the state is committed the responsibility of having a public legal order, of creating the laws for the public and then enforcing them. And to the state it falls to defend the country if it's under attack, threatened with external invasion. Well, we'll come to all that in more detail when we reassume our class. We'll go into Locke's theory in greater detail, and then we'll see how Locke's theory affected other people as they made their theories and devised governments and organized and reorganized them. And that's on the docket for next time. See you then.